This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you looked out the window of our Philadelphia radio studio yesterday, what you saw was a long line of media trucks and a lot of security preparing for the Clinton-Obama debate at the Constitution Center. It's directly across the street from us. The campaign and media circus has been in town. We invited Dave Davies to talk with us about covering the Pennsylvania primary race for the Philadelphia Daily News and tell us what goes on behind the scenes as the campaign's staff and surrogates give their talking points and daily spin. You probably know Dave as a frequent guest host of Fresh Air. He's also a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News and has covered local government and politics for the past 20 years. Hi, Dave. Well, you were across the street last night from the WHYY headquarters at the Constitution Center covering the debate. And you were telling me before that your deadline was 10:15, which is 15 minutes after the debate ended. So how do you file so quickly?
You do what sports writers do, which is that you write the story as the event is happening. In this case, I was working with a partner. Catherine Lucy was back at the newspaper watching on television, and she and I were both taking notes, and we would trade emails because I had wireless internet, and we would talk on the phone during the breaks and say, you'll do a section on this part, I'll do Social Security, and I would feed it all into her, and then she would work with an editor to put the final version together. But it's really, really intense, and it makes it hard to get the same perspective you would have if you were just sitting back and kind of taking the whole event in, because you're really doing two things at once. You're trying to focus on what the story is, and you're writing the story as it happens.
Now, you were in not the main room that we were seeing. You were in a reporter's room. So what was that room like?
Well, it's typical of big events like this. There's a media filing center, which is row upon row of tables with power outlets so that everyone can plug in their laptops, and then multiple audio boxes for the broadcast folks. And it is a sea of reporters that are all sitting at their laptops watching the debate on a big screen TV and intently trying to take notes and file as they go. Some who have less pressing deadlines will get up and wander around. There's coffee and pretzels and food and chatting. And you see, you know, folks that you see on cable TV wandering around. So there's a kind of a little bit of a big event sort of festive air to it. But mostly it's the great unwashed masses of journalism really under a lot of pressure working hard to get the story in. And right, and they don't see what people inside the debate room see. They really see what happens on television.
And when do the spinners enter the picture?
There is a spin room. In this case, it was downstairs and away from the actual filing center. I've been in debates where it's adjacent to the filing center and the spinners actually begin entering before the debate is over because they know what kind of deadlines pressure reporters face. And this is a funny thing to see because what you have, the spinners are campaign staff and elected officials, allies and surrogates of the two candidates. And as they wander into the room, they have an aide behind them holding a little wooden sign over their head identifying them so that reporters will know who they're talking to. And then there's this chaotic scene where these clusters of reporters gather around these people who offer their spin and interpretation of what happens.
So you were expecting that the Pennsylvania primary was going to be inconsequential because it comes so late in the campaign season. And as it turns out, as we all know, it's crucial for the Democratic race. So describe what the daily spin machine has been like for you as a Philadelphia reporter.
It's a variation on what I'm familiar with covering other races that I've covered that are multi-million dollar budget races, like races for mayor or governor. I mean, when a reporter is covering one of those races, when I've covered them, I'll talk frequently, almost every day, with people on the campaign staff who have these long conversations, typically off the record, at which they want you to often to do negative stories about their opponent. They're complaining about the treatment that you're giving them. They're, you know, putting out the message of the day and trying to direct you to some shady thing in the opponent's past. But that's typically all done off the record, and they hope that you will do the work of tearing their opponent down and spare them the risk of doing it publicly. What's interesting about a national campaign is that because instead of 8 or 10 reporters following the race intently, there are a couple of hundred, the spinning is done in conference calls at which the campaign operatives will email to reporters an 800 number and a passcode. And so hundreds of reporters will call in at a designated hour and listen to the spin machine from the campaign operatives. And because they can't strike an off-the-record agreement with 200 reporters in a conference call, it's all on the record. So it's an odd sort of variation on this. And typically, a lot of the conversation that goes on in these efforts to spin reporters don't yield stories because they don't merit them. But in this national context, because there are bloggers who need 24-hour material and talk show hosts and cable TV hosts, and because it's on the record and is available on the internet, there's this sort of churning sub-campaign in which the campaign operatives are spreading venom and vitriol, which insiders and reporters see and hear, which is really at odds with what's going on in the campaign that voters see. I mean, the candidates are speaking in civil tones, and their ads convey positive messages. But the insiders sort of see this nasty, sharp, divisive campaign that's sort of sub rosa. Now, that changed about a week ago when Hillary Clinton began running negative stuff, and the public campaign began to be negative as well.
How do the two campaigns compare and how they've handled spin, and particularly in how they've handled the negative spin that they're putting out?
You know, it's interesting because when I had a chance to interview Barack Obama, I wanted to ask him about this because it did seem to me that his public commitment to transcend partisanship and run a positive campaign to some extent was inconsistent with his own people constantly trying to encourage negative stories about Hillary Clinton. And in preparation for that interview, I went back to look for examples of it. And it did seem to me, when I looked more carefully, that the Clinton campaign was more frequently and stridently engaged in that kind of negative spin. Now, the Obama folks did it, and they certainly encouraged a lot of negative stories. But when I heard their campaign manager, for example, and listened more carefully, it seemed like his heart wasn't quite in it. Or maybe he knew that he was in a campaign where they didn't really want to sound like that. On the other hand, he wanted reporters to do the negative stories. So they would tend to have surrogates make the more harsh attack, or in pitching a negative story themselves, do it a little more cautiously.
And what did Obama tell you when you asked him the question?
I began by citing some examples of where his own full-time campaign staff had said really negative things about Hillary and had encouraged reporters to write negative stories about Hillary Clinton. And as soon as I began talking, he began nodding his head up and down, and he said, "This is a tension at this point in the campaign." And essentially what happened was there came to be a point at which a Clinton campaign operative said that we're going to throw the kitchen sink at Obama, and they were doing regular conference calls pitching this stuff. And my staff and I decided that this is Obama speaking. He said that his staff had concluded they needed to get in the game too. Otherwise, there would be no other message getting out there. Now, the kitchen sink quote that he referred to, I checked, that was in a New York Times story. They quoted an anonymous Clinton staffer at saying that they were going to be throwing the kitchen sink at Obama. When I followed up and asked, "Well, did you personally approve this change in strategy?" he shook his head no and said, "Look, this is what happens in a campaign. I knew national politics would be tough, and it is tough."
Now, you got an interview with Obama. How did you get it, and what were the ground rules?
It's interesting. The Obama campaign was very disciplined about trying to grant one-on-one interviews to most of the local reporters covering the campaign. And what they did was they would tell you ahead of time, he is going to be at an event in your area. In my case, it was Wallingford, a suburb. And you'll get 7 minutes. And you go to the event and you wait. There's a period after the campaign, after the event. And then you're ushered to a room where, in this case, I was one of three reporters that were given 7 minutes. They do this a lot, particularly with television reporters, because they know that the TV stations love to promote the fact that their person was one-on-one in a chair with Obama. And in fact, the day that I did mine, I noticed that one of the local stations had their opportunity the day before. And when they presented it on television, it was as if their reporter had spent the entire day with Obama. They had begun by ordering room service, practically. And so they know that there's a bit of hype to that, but it increases the exposure for their candidate. I write columns sometimes for the Daily News, and I think they hoped that I would write a column off of this interview. I didn't because he didn't say anything very new. He's very disciplined about it. But it was a 7-minute interview with a campaign aide literally holding a stopwatch to make sure that we didn't go over the time.
And did he say your 7 minutes are up?
No, I was sort of aware of it, and I kind of looked at him and I said, "Do you have a couple of more minutes?" And so I finished. You know, the honest truth is that I don't pursue a one-on-one interview with these guys just to have it. I mean, I'm not a TV reporter that needs to be shown on television sitting down with them. I want to talk to them if I feel there's something that I can ask them that I haven't heard anybody ask. And in this case, there were a couple of questions like that. I don't have any illusion that if I sit down and ask them the same question that they have heard 500 times, I'm going to get anything different. I ask a question when I think there's something I actually want to know.
What are the other questions you wanted to ask them?
The other one was one of them was that I had noticed that when he came to the Philadelphia area, all of his appearances, all of his public events were in the suburbs, despite the fact that his true hardcore base of support, his greatest base of support in the state were African-American communities in Philadelphia. And I asked him whether in a state with Pennsylvania's demographics, candidly, do you prefer to have TV images with adoring white people looking at you rather than in the post-Jeremiah Wright era, being seen with a crowd of very enthusiastic black supporters? And he assured me, of course, that that was not the case, that what they were doing was to go into areas where they are less well-known and meet people, which is actually a perfectly sound political strategy. But that was a pattern. Then I also asked him about pledged delegates, because not long before our interview, Hillary Clinton had appeared at a meeting with reporters and our editorial board and had expressed the idea that not just superdelegates, but that even pledged delegates aren't committed to vote for anybody and can change their minds. And so I wanted to ask him his reaction to that and whether if she began trying to convince his pledged delegates, would he do the same and try and persuade some of hers?
And he said?
He skillfully deflected it all. And he said, we're focused right now on getting Pennsylvania. I mean, these guys are good at not making news.
Did you talk to Hillary Clinton one-on-one?
Didn't. Didn't ask for it because I didn't kind of have things that I really wanted to get at her. And I think when we met with her in our editorial board meeting, we as reporters sat down. And I did ask her some questions then and felt like we had a pretty good exchange. She sat with us for quite a while and we asked some pretty tough questions. And so I didn't feel the need to seek a one-on-one with her.
Did any news come out of that editorial meeting?
Actually, it did. And this was partly timing. She met with us right about the time that the controversy over her landing in Bosnia had really flowered into a big public issue, the CBS videotape, which clearly contradicted her version of what happened, had gotten around. And one of our reporters, Will Bunch, asked her directly, confronted her with the quotes that she had given a week before. And she, for the first time, admitted that she'd gotten it wrong. And that was one of those interesting kind of journalistic moments, because I think as that story kind of was bubbling, you know, there's always a debate about how important is it that she misrepresented this thing? How important is it? And when we wrote the story, I don't think we made a big deal about it. But when we put her answer on a blog post, it made news. It was played and replayed on cable TV all night and was widely quoted, which, of course, and so the Daily News got credit for a little campaign scoop that day.
My guest is Dave Davies. You probably recognize his voice as a frequent guest host on Fresh Air. He's covered Philadelphia politics and government for about 20 years. He writes for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he's been covering the Pennsylvania primary for the Philadelphia Daily News. And we're talking about what it's like when the big primary carnival comes to town and you're covering it. How do you think the blogs and YouTube are affecting campaign coverage? Has it affected how you cover the story?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as a reader, I always feel that if I'm going to invest my time in reading something, I want it to be something that someone has at least spent a day thinking about. I mean, researching the facts, developing some context, giving it some insight. But nowadays, reporters don't have that luxury. Even people who work for daily papers or weekly publications have to file constantly online to keep up with everyone. And then the bloggers are filing all the time. And newspaper reporters are expected to run to maintain blogs and contribute to blogs as well. And it's interesting because, you know, years ago, there's a lot of downtime at these big public campaign events because it takes a while for candidates to get there. And years ago, you would see reporters wait while they're waiting for the event to start, out talking to voters and talking to campaign operators and talking to each other. Now they're all buried in their laptops. They all have wireless internet, and they are searching the net for material and filing stuff. And it means that a lot of what campaign coverage becomes are these little mini nuggets of stuff, the sort of undigested material. And it, I think, sometimes tends to exaggerate the importance of little flaps, and I think it makes the community a little more insular. Now, the other side of it is that there's an enormous amount of information out there. I mean, when folks are sitting at their laptops, they also have access, immediate access, to all kinds of research and what other people are writing. And I also think it does hold the media more accountable. I mean, it's there's just no doubt that so many more eyes are on what we do that, you know, no one voice dominates, and that's a good thing.
Since you've been covering Philadelphia government and politics for about 20 years, let me ask you some of the behind-the-scenes reasons that you know of why Pennsylvania leaders have chosen to back who they've chosen to back. For instance, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter is supporting Hillary Clinton. Are there behind-the-scenes reasons that help explain his choice?
Well, he goes way back with the Clintons. When he was a city councilman, he was a Clinton delegate to, I believe, the 1992 convention. Might have been 96. So he's known them from way back. In the 90s, the Clintons were very friendly to Philadelphia, friendly to its mayor, Ed Rendell, who's now the governor. And they were in town a lot. So a lot of Democrats in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia got to know the Clintons and respect them and like them because, you know, they were helpful in all kinds of ways, in regulatory ways and funding ways. And so I think the relationship really grew then. So I think there was already an intense personal relationship and loyalty. And then I think, you know, there was the point at which early on, it looked as if she would be the nominee. And if you want to get credit for supporting somebody who everybody in the end is going to support, doing it early really helps. And so I think it was sort of partly personal loyalty and personal relationships and partly getting on the bandwagon before everybody else is on. One more thing. Mike Nutter won a five-way race for the Democratic nomination for mayor last year, and one of his chief competitors was Congressman Shaka Fatah from Philadelphia. And Fatah had a relationship with Obama. Obama came in, hosted a fundraiser for Fatah's congressional committee. I don't think he per se endorsed him, but there was a closeness there, and I think there was a sense. I mean, Fatah certainly spoke a lot about Obama and endorsed Obama. So it might have been that, you know, Nutter, he was close to Hillary Clinton, knew her well, saw Obama as, you know, kind of hanging around with his chief mayoral rival. He has been asked about this and said it had absolutely nothing to do with it. But it aligns the same way.
Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell also endorsing Hillary Clinton, behind-the-scenes reasons?
Yeah, not just endorsing. I mean, he is just enthusiastically, intensely partisan about this. He had a very good close relationship with Bill Clinton when Clinton was in the White House in the 1990s. Ed Rendell took over the city in 1992 when it was completely bankrupt and discouraged. And, you know, Clinton goes into the White House in 93, and they just really clicked. I mean, they're people who are a lot alike. They're, you know, lawyers of a certain age, both real policy wonks, both charismatic politicians, who are, you know, are given the kind of explosive tempers but big hearts. And they had a great relationship. Clinton brought a lot to the city of Philadelphia. He named it one of 10 empowerment zones, which brought a lot of money for economic development to the city. Ed Rendell, who is a prodigious political fundraiser, raised a ton of money for Bill Clinton and got others to contribute. So that relationship all through the 90s, I think, practically preordained that he would be with Hillary, and he has been.
Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey Jr. has endorsed Barack Obama. What are some of the behind-the-scenes reasons for that endorsement?
That's the really interesting one. You know, Bob Casey is a pro-life Democrat from Scranton in the eastern part of the state. And that endorsement was particularly helpful to Obama because his base are the white working class union-affiliated people that Obama tended to poll poorly in and needed to increase his support. And so it was very, very helpful. I think Casey, well, what he said was that his four young daughters just loved Obama. And that kind of opened him up to new voices of voters. It was also clear Obama seemed to be marching toward the nomination. And again, if you help somebody at the right time, good for your future. And then there's people with long memories will remember an old Clinton-Casey grudge. Bob Casey's father was a governor in Pennsylvania, also named Bob Casey. And in 1992, he was snubbed at the Democratic convention that nominated Bill Clinton. He was, you know, not allowed to speak. His pro-life views were very out of sync with the dominant, you know, sentiment in the Democratic Party. And that really bothered the Casey family. And I think there's just never been a warm relationship between the Caseys and the Clintons. I don't think that's per se what motivated him to do it, but a lot of people noted that, you know, they didn't like the way they were treated, and now the Clintons didn't like this.
Dave, what are some of the differences between how the political game is played when it comes to local politics versus national politics, which is what you're covering right now?
Yeah, I think, wasn't it Tip O'Neill who said all politics is local? The same principles apply, really, if you compare it to, say, Philadelphia mayor's race. I mean, they're big budget campaigns. They have to raise a ton of money. They have a media consultant who figures out what the message ought to be and then makes radio and television ads, which are the most expensive part of a campaign. And they try to get endorsements from other elected officials and union leaders. So it really is kind of the same game. The difference nationally is just it is on such a scale that in terms of the media relations, you don't get quite the same intensive personal relationship that you do in a local race. I mean, I have to say, one of the reasons that I don't love covering politics is that when I cover a mayor or a governor's race, I spend so much time on the phone being harangued by campaign operatives and having my every journalistic judgment questioned.
And do you spend a lot of time defending yourself, or you just listen and then let it go?
No, you have to come back. And in a certain way, it keeps you sharp because you really do have to think through things. On the other hand, there is a point at which you just got to say, you know, stop whining. I call them like I see them. This is the way I saw that one. And I don't mind conceding a point. I mean, there are times when I'll say, you know, you're right. Could have done that a little differently. If I had to do it again, I might. Or a headline writer might have stuck something on the piece which sort of – that I wouldn't have particularly liked. But it's in some respects what's so distasteful about it is that I feel these are soulless operatives who just will tell you anything. And a lot of what they sell doesn't check out. And it's just it's a tiresome process.
One of the maybe silly things that candidates are forced to do when they're campaigning in a city is do all the things that the city is known for. You know, so in every city, there's a certain food you have to eat. In Philadelphia, you have to have a cheesesteak. And there's certain, you know, like diners or churches or synagogues that you have to go to. So how has that played out in Philadelphia?
They really haven't done much of that stuff. Senator Obama did do a walking tour of the Italian market, which is this wonderful kind of old open-air market. But then he bought like a really expensive ham, and so people made a big deal out of him having high, you know, refined tastes. But they haven't – I don't think either candidate's eaten the cheesesteak, haven't really done the diner tour. They will certainly do black churches on the Sunday before the election. But no, they really kind of haven't embraced the cultural artifacts the way these folks sometimes do. Maybe because there's risks in it. When John Kerry was at one of the cheesesteak places, and in fact, I had a personal connection to this story. He went up to Pat's Steaks, which everybody in Philadelphia knows is sort of one of the legendary cheesesteak places. He went in and ordered his sandwich, and I went in and asked the clerk, well, what did he order? And the clerk said, well, he ordered Swiss cheese on his cheesesteak, which was just ridiculous for anybody in Philadelphia. And I was going to save that for a little gossip piece a few days later, but another reporter overheard me. It ended up becoming a national story. And it kind of fed this notion that Kerry was elitist and out of touch. It's sort of one of those ways in which engaging in this sort of silly stuff can blow up.
Yeah, were you sorry that you asked? Because they made such a big deal of the fact that he ordered Swiss cheese when usually you – well, actually what you usually get is Cheese Whiz.
Yeah, you get Cheese Whiz.
Really?
Right. No, I wasn't sorry because it was fun. I mean, you know, and poking a little fun at him is fine. I was just sorry that I didn't put it in the paper the next day. That's a lesson that I learned.
Well, the circus will soon be leaving town because the primary is Tuesday. Are you looking forward to the end of the Pennsylvania primary?
I am. I mean, partly because it's so intense and exhausting. These big events are huge, sort of tiresome, time-wasting affairs. But much more because, you know, when I'm working on local reporting, I get the satisfaction of having an impact. it's very different covering a story in which you're one of one or two people on it than when you're one of 200 people on it. I did some stories recently about the slow response of the city's 911 ambulance system. There was a horrendous case of a woman who died after not getting a ride for nearly 2 hours. And that and some other stories led to a policy response and some additional funding for the city's 911 system. That's a lot more satisfying than chasing these blogs around and kind of following this national story in which it's really, really hard to do any original reporting. And that's, you know, the other thing I have to say is that one of the things that worries me about the state of journalism and the decline of newspapers is the threat to local investigative reporting. There will always be people to write about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But if the economic base of newspapers continues to decline, who's going to look at the payroll of the local school board or the sleazy contracts that are being handed out, you know, by local officials? I mean, this is a city with a lot of problems. The city spends $3 billion a year, and somebody really needs to keep an eye on that. And I'm happy to be doing that.
Well, Dave, thank you for describing to us some of the things you've been covering and experiencing during the Pennsylvania primary as you cover it for the Philadelphia Daily News. And thanks, of course, as well, to frequently hosting, guest hosting Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
It's fun to be in the same show.
Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and a Fresh Air guest host and contributor. There were 23 senators who voted against authorizing President Bush to take us to war in Iraq. My guest, Lincoln Chafee, was the only Republican. He also voted against the president's tax cuts. Two examples of how this senator from Rhode Island was at odds with the Bush White House and got the reputation of being the most liberal Republican senator of the Bush years. He was also a member of the so-called Gang of 14, seven Democrats and seven Republicans who reached a compromise on how to deal with filibusters of President Bush's judicial nominees. Now Chafee has written a memoir called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. Chafee was the mayor of Warwick and planning a run for the Senate to take over the seat of his retiring father, John Chafee, when John Chafee died in 1999. The governor appointed Lincoln Chafee to take over his father's position. He won the election in 2000. In 2006, he lost to his Democratic opponent, Sheldon Whitehouse. Chafee is now teaching at Brown University. Lincoln Chafee, welcome to Fresh Air. In your book, you write that in the decades before 1994, this is before the Republicans swept Congress, before the so-called Republican Revolution, there were 24 moderate Republican senators who would meet for lunch in the Capitol every Wednesday to build camaraderie and talk about how they would work together in the week to come. But you say by the time you got to the Senate in 1999, only 5 Republicans were willing to be seen at the moderates' table. Why was that?
Yes, originally my father, who had preceded me in the Senate, was part of a much larger moderate Republican group stretching across the country. Nancy Kassenbaum from Kansas, for instance, and Alan Simpson from Wyoming. And by the time I got there, it had shrunk to the 5, two Maine senators, Snow and Collins. Jeffords was still a Republican from Vermont, Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, myself. And as the South turned from conservative Democrats to conservative Republicans, the agenda of the Republican Party switched to conservative, dictated from these Southern senators. And I saw it in my lifetime, a solid Democratic South, slowly, year by year, turned to almost solidly Republican. Very, very conservative, just as they were as Democrats, but now they're Republicans. And they set the agenda for the Republican Party.
You write in your book that nothing in Congress could pass without moderate support if the moderates stuck together. But, you say, the administration had a plan for making sure the moderates did not stick together. What is the plan that you're referring to?
Well, that's my theory, that the tax cut was very premeditated. That tax cut of the spring of 2001, a $1.6 trillion tax cut. And to put it in perspective, President Clinton had vetoed in October, so just several months earlier, a $400 billion tax cut. And Clinton, in his veto message, said it's irresponsible, it jeopardizes the surplus. This is $400 billion. And now here we were debating a $1.6 trillion tax cut. And my theory is that every politician, of course, likes to vote to cut taxes. There's nothing more popular than cutting taxes if you're a politician. And so the administration was serving up this almost irresistible temptation in order to get Congress on their side. And I saw my fellow moderates peel away one by one, support this $1.6 trillion tax cut. I was left alone in opposition. And that broke our moderate coalition right off the bat. It was very premeditated, in my view.
So you think that one of the purposes of proposing the tax cut early on in the Bush administration was to break the moderates as a unified group?
Yes, and also to, as I say, neuter Congress, that show that the executive branch is going to run the show. And the first order of business is the most popular thing you can do is tax cuts. And one by one, they rolled over. The chairman of the Finance Committee, Senator Grassley from Iowa, initially said he opposed it. He fell in line. And so it worked to perfection, as we now know.
You write in your book about your first meeting with Vice President Cheney, and this was right after the election, and he met with you and the other four members of the moderate Republicans who met weekly with each other. Tell us what that meeting was like.
Yes, this was the day after the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Bush-Cheney after the long recount of Florida, December of 2000. And Senator Spector had invited him to join us. And when I read the news that the Supreme Court had ruled that night, I thought, oh, he'll have better things to do than meet with us. But he kept the appointment, and we met in Senator Spector's Capitol office. And it was just the six of us, the vice president and the five moderate senators. And I was shocked that, and there's a cliche, you almost fell off your chair. I almost fell off my chair at that lunch as he outlined this divisive agenda. And it's big tax cuts, it's getting out of international agreements. And to me, this is contrary to what you ran on, is what I'm thinking. You said, I'm a uniter, not a divider. And now you're going to enact this divisive agenda. Governor Bush, the candidate, had said, when Jim Lehrer in the debates asked him, what kind of foreign policy are you going to have? Fair question to ask the candidate for President of the United States. And the candidate, Governor Bush, had said, we're going to have a humble foreign policy. If they're arrogant, they'll resent it. And at the time, I was cheering that, saying that's the kind of candidate I want. And here at this lunch with the vice president, just hours after the Supreme Court has ruled, he's saying the opposite. We're going to have an arrogant foreign policy. We're going to be divisive. And two things struck me. Number one, how quickly they were going back on their campaign pledges. And secondly, how can the vice president have the confidence, the vice president, to outline this agenda just hours after the Supreme Court has ruled? To me, that said that the vice president's going to be a very, very powerful figure in this administration. He's speaking just these hours after the Supreme Court has ruled about this very, very different agenda from what was part of the campaign rhetoric. And at that lunch, I saw my fellow moderates not pushing back on this agenda. And that gave me a sinking feeling that we wouldn't have this key five-block vote, which would be so fun to exercise the power. I mean, it was so rare and fortuitous, if you will, that it's a 50-50 Senate. We have the power, these five moderate senators. And I saw at that lunch us not exercising that cohesiveness we needed to at that lunch.
What did you say? And did you do anything to exercise your power?
I was the junior member, and we go by seniority. That's the way the Senate works, even at an informal lunch. So when my turn came, if you will, I was saying, you're going to need our votes. And the vice president just didn't seem to. He said, we'll get the votes. Every vote's important, if I recall, was his comment. And in other words, I'm not going to kowtow to this group. That was the message.
How much direct contact did you have with President Bush?
Well, right after the tax cut, I did vote against it, and I expected to be the only Republican to vote against the tax cut. As it turned out, John McCain surprised everybody by voting against the tax cut in the spring of 2001. And I felt, well, I'm going to disagree with my party, my president here. This is unfortunate. We're getting off to a bad start. Let me meet with him one-on-one. And the White House accepted that, and I went down to the Oval Office. And I came out of that meeting more rattled than I went in. It was just the two of us, President Bush and myself, and I came kind of to say, I know there's going to be issues we're going to disagree with, but where can we find common ground? And I said, this agenda is going to jeopardize Republican seats in the 2002 elections, which are coming up. We just got wiped out, and 2000 went from a good majority to a 50-50 Senate in 2002. And he just didn't want to talk about it. He said, don't you worry about what we're going to do. And I came out of that meeting very rattled and concerned about the leadership of the country at that time, which served me well when they started talking about Saddam Hussein being a threat and other things, I was on my guard, and it served me well.
You know, in writing about your meeting with President Bush, you describe how you brought up the issue of abortion, and you brought the name of Laura Bush into the discussion. Tell us what you said.
Well, as a case in point, that going back on the campaign promises, if you're a uniter, not a divider, I mean, over and over again, I can remember that phrase in the campaign. The president, the first act after he was sworn in as in inauguration, very first act was abortion, taking on an abortion. And however you might feel about it, there's no denying it's a divisive and a highly emotional issue. And so if you're going to be a uniter, it's the last issue you'd want to take on, not the first. And so at the meeting, the two of us in the Oval Office, I said, why are we getting into this abortion issue? It's so divisive. People feel so strongly about it. It's very, very emotional. And I said, even Laura, your wife is pro-choice. And he snapped at me. You keep my wife out of this, he said. I remember it. And that ended that conversation. On to the next.
Is Laura Bush pro-choice?
Yes, I'd seen in an article somewhere, and as I sat there at the meeting, I was scratching my head to think, am I accurate on that? Do I recall that article accurately? And I did go back afterwards and find it, and she had said something to that effect. And he didn't deny it. He didn't say, no, she isn't. He said, you leave my wife out of this.
One of the important votes that you write about in your book is the vote in Congress authorizing the president to take us to war. And you're still angry at how that was handled in Congress. You're angry that it was rushed through. Tell us, from your perspective in the Senate at the time, how it was rushed through.
Well, angry is just one of my feelings. As we look at 4,000 dead and we're arguing whether it's $2 trillion or $3 trillion or $4 trillion in the cost. And worst of all, if there is something worst of all in this whole debacle, is that there's no good way out. There's just no good way out now. And so angry is just one of the ways I feel. And the big issue is that we didn't have a true discussion about what the administration really wanted to do there. They were dialing up the fear, and that certainly sold well after September 11th. Saddam Hussein's a threat. He has weapons of mass destruction. That was the mood at the time. And so the vote was being taken place in October of 2002, which is the midterm elections are just weeks away in November. And so it was all caught up in the politics at the same time. And after Jeffords had switched across the aisle, the Democrats had the majority, and the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Levin from Michigan, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, the most important committee, I would think, on this issue, was urging us to slow it down. And he had an amendment just hours before the war authorization just to slow it down. And that was defeated by almost the same vote as the war resolution was approved. It was a terrible performance by Congress.
You write that you think Republicans and Democrats remain entrenched at the political extremes.
Yes.
Examples of that?
Well, after the 2006 elections, in which I lost, DeWine from Ohio lost, Santorum from Pennsylvania lost, Burns from Montana lost, Talent from Missouri lost, Allen from Virginia, I think I have them all, six of us lost, all incumbents. And as we know, incumbents have a huge advantage. The first thing we did after that wipeout, we met to elect our leadership. And Lamar Alexander was running for the whip position. He's not a liberal by any means, but a different voice in our leadership in the Republican Senate. And he was defeated by one vote by Senator Lott, who was making a comeback. And I said to myself, we're not changing. We're not changing. Let's have one different voice in our leadership of our Senate. There's four or five members of our leadership, which we vote for. And that said, we're not changing. We're stuck in our partisan trenches.
How do you think the Democrats remain entrenched in a political extreme?
Well, they've been more ineffective in standing up to this radical agenda, and that's my criticism. Even in the last September, there was a vote to declare the Iranian guards as a terrorist organization. Again, to me, just giving the Bush-Cheney administration tickets to commence hostilities against Iran. And that was a huge vote, 70 to 25 or something. And the Democrats just can't stand up to this administration. That's what I've seen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lincoln Chafee, the former Republican senator from Rhode Island, and he served from 1999 to 2006. He was considered the most liberal Republican in the Senate during his tenure. He's written a new memoir called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. In your book, you referred to when the Black Congressional Caucus, just after the contested election of 2000, asked for a senator, any senator, to object to the way the results were handled. And no senator was willing to do it. It seems like you're sorry that you didn't do it yourself. Is that right? Like, if you had it to do over again, you would have stood up and contested the election?
Oh, that was very, very memorable. And since most elections are don't involve such razor-thin margins and 5-4 Supreme Court decisions, this was very unique. And as we learned about this arcane electoral college process, one of these constitutional provisions is that one member of the Congress can stand up and ask a senator to object, and that sets in motion a chain of events, not necessarily changing the election, but at least it sets in motion some chains of events. And the members of the Black Caucus, we were meeting in the House of Representatives as Vice President Gore counted the electoral ballots, which would lead to his loss, and the members of the Black Caucus were standing up saying, begging any senator, Republican or Democrat, to object. And I think all of us thought that that we've put this behind us, we're going to move on, we've got a uniter, not a divider, we've got a humble foreign policy. The candidates had pledged to regulate carbon dioxide, so they'll have an environmental program. If we had known that they were going to go back on all these pledges and how radical they'd be, certainly I would have raised my hand and set in motion that chain of constitutional events.
Do you feel like Gore set a tone that he didn't want anybody to object?
Yes. He had conceded, and he did set that tone. You're absolutely right. As I sat there, he was willing to move on.
The last time we spoke, a couple of years ago, you said that you lost your seat to a Democrat in the Senate, but you were glad that the Democrats had the majority now in the Senate. Do you still stand by that? And how effectively, from your point of view, do you think they used their majority?
Yes, I do think it was important that there be the proper questions asked. Have I been disappointed that more of these proper questions haven't been asked of the executive branch? Yes, but at least it hasn't been a complete all the committee chairs being of the same party and no questions being asked. That has changed, and I think that's good for democracy and good for America at this time in our history after this administration, which no one can deny has been very, very radical in their agenda.
Am I right in saying that when you were running for re-election in 2006 when you were defeated, that John McCain supported you?
Yes, I was in a very much a no-win position of making the decision to look after Rhode Island, my state, and knowing there were some very, very important bills coming up as I contemplated running in 2006. I knew exactly what I was in for. This was the Rhode Islanders would be mad at the Republican agenda. They're not going to be happy with President Bush, and he and Cheney were not going to be on the ballot. I would in 2006. And so I made the decision to run as a Republican and look after my state as best I could. And as such, I had to attract those Republicans in which I shared some points of view, and certainly with Senator McCain and the environment and the Gang of 14, I had some commonalities.
So after John McCain supported you in 2006 for your reelection, is it awkward for you now to not be supporting him?
Yes, but that's part of politics. And once I lost the election in 2006, it gave me some freedom to think about my future. And the war is the big issue. I mean, that he and I agree on the environmental issues, and he was the leader in the Gang of 14. But the war trumps everything else. And he's still insisting that was a good move. And as I said earlier, it's the cost in so many ways and the lack of options. It was a terrible decision.
You lost your election in 2006, and you've been teaching at Brown University People say, I don't know if you've made it official, but that you're considering a run for governor of Rhode Island in 2010. But you're an independent now. You know, a lot of people thought you'd switch to Democrat because you'd been so isolated as a Republican and so liberal compared to the rest of your party. How come you decided to leave your party and become an independent?
I guess lines of liberalism and conservatism cross somewhere, and you've said several times in the course of the interview, the most liberal Republican, which I'm proud to be called, but on some of the issues, fiscal issues, I consider that conservative to protect our surpluses. And I do consider it conservative to look after our environment. I think that's long-range conservative thinking to make sure we have clean air and clean water. And not getting involved in these foreign entanglements, to me, and Pat Buchanan would agree with me, that's conservative. And when I decided to leave the Republican Party, particularly after that vote I talked about where my Senate leadership wasn't going to change after losing those six incumbents, me included. And it took me about 6 months to think about it. And here in Rhode Island, we call it unaffiliated. So I'm an unaffiliated voter. And assessing the future, it gives me a chance. But I did want to not be a Republican anymore. And what I saw, the fact that they weren't changing.
Lincoln Chafee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me on your great show.
Lincoln Chafee is a former Republican senator from Rhode Island. He's currently a visiting fellow at Brown University. His memoir is called Against the Tide. I'm Terry Gross.